Today's Taste Show is on Case 42 in the Wu Mong Kan. Case 42 is entitled The Girl Comes Out of Samadhi. Once in the old days, in the time of the World Honored One, Manjushri went to the assembly of the Buddhas and found that everyone had departed to his original dwelling place. Only a girl remained, sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Manjushri asked Shakyamuni Buddha, "Why can the girl get near the Buddha's throne while I cannot?" Shakyamuni Buddha said, "Bring her out of samadhi and ask her yourself." Manjushri walked around the girl three times, snapped his fingers once, took her up to Brahma heaven, and exerted all his miraculous powers to bring her out of her meditation, but in vain. The World Honored One said, "Even 100,000 Manjushris cannot wake her up." But down below, past 1,200 million lands, as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there is the Bodhisattva Momyo. He will be able to rouse her from her samadhi. Instantly, the Bodhisattva Momyo emerged from the earth and made a bow to the World Honored One, who gave him his imperial order. The Bodhisattva went over to the girl and snapped his fingers once. At this, she came out of samadhi. Mumon's comment, old Shakyamuni put a petty drama on the stage and failed to enlighten the masses. I want to ask you, Manjushri is the teacher of the seven Buddhas. Why couldn't he arouse the girl from her samadhi? And how was it that Momyo, a beginner at the Buddhist, a bodhisattva at the beginner stage, could do it? If you understand this intimately, you will enjoy Naga's grand samadhi in the busiest activity of consciousness. Mumon's verse, one was successful, the other not, both secured freedom of mind. One in a god mask, the other in a devil's mask. Even in defeat, a beautiful performance. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning, on this wonderful summer morning. Everybody was sitting very deeply, very impressive. It's quite wonderful to see that kind of wholehearted practice. So, this is summer, and it looks like we're going to be able to go out of our houses. Many of us are vaccinated now, and it's possible to go back into life and explore life once again and more directly. It might be a little hard, though, the transition, right? I was listening to the radio, and they were talking about people who actually are having a hard time reintegrating, right? It was such a shock not to go into work, not to go into your class, wherever you usually do your work, and to stay at home and work online, work with your Zoom, with your computer and using Zoom, right? It was a shock. And many people, you know, began to go stir crazy, right? I mean, you're every day you get up, you go to your computer, you sit and do Zoom meetings all day. Next day, get up, go to your room, sit down at your computer, same thing next day, and so on. I think many people around, say, March were thinking, I don't know if I can take another 6 months of this regimen, right, of sitting in front of my computer all day and never going out, you know, going to the grocery store with masks on. And last year at this time, I would go to the grocery store with masks and gloves because we weren't sure that you couldn't get it from through the skin. So, you know, we went through this long, very difficult year and a half, a little bit less than that. And even though it was a shock to the system, you know, many of us have gotten used to working online and doing things online, like we're sitting together today. And actually, I think this is a wonderful idea. I'm hoping that in August we can have our sesshin in person at Murray Grove. We have our online sesshin this time because probably only about 35% of New Jerseyans are vaccinated. But by August, everybody should be vaccinated. We should be safe. Rutgers has still not opened up, for example, fully. So, you know, we all went through a transition. It was difficult, and we learned some things. I mean, I think we'll continue to use the computer for our sits, even though we'll have in-person sitting as well. But, you know, it took some time to get used to it. Now that we've gotten used to it, it's hard to transition back for some people. And that's actually understandable. You know, the way we create our reality is through repetition, right? So, you know, we create our sense of reality and our sense of time through repetition. You know, so what makes something real is repeating and repeating and repeating. And gradually it becomes real. You know, so the first time you do something or you go someplace new, if you're unprepared, it has a kind of unreal quality, right? Everything is rushed. Everything seems a little bit incoherent, right? And it's like one thing happening after another. And after, especially if it wasn't particularly traumatic, you know, even if it were pleasant, you might say, you know, what happened? What just happened? You know, so what makes something real is going from that stage of like flux or fluidity to a kind of patterns behavior. So you know, one of the things we learn in growing up is to pattern our behavior. You know, so when little kids are unaware, really, that, you know, 8 o'clock is time to go to bed or whenever you send your kids to bed. You know, my parents would send us to bed at 8:30. It was like, it's 8:30, time for bed. And we'd say, but we want to watch the movie with you. No, you have to go to bed, you know. And so we would go to bed. And, you know, you get used to, you know, being tired around 8:30, right? You train yourself to have a drowsiness at 8:15, and then you train yourself to get up at a certain hour. And in this way, we create like the fabric of reality through repetition, patterns that are repeated over and over again. And as we repeat, things take on a kind of quality of reality, right? You know, I can remember the first time I went to school, how unusual that was and how, because, of course, like everybody else, I had spent all my time at home. And then one day I was going to go to kindergarten. And I was living in Baltimore at the time. And I was going to go to kindergarten at York Elementary School near Lock Raven Boulevard, if you know Baltimore. And, you know, I was so excited. And I remember we were sitting in class and the teacher said, "And now Mr. Mack is going to come and take us to the lavatory." And I thought he said laboratory. You know, I was so excited about going to see the chemical, the beakers bubbling and the test tubes. You know, so this is school, right? And instead he took us to the bathroom, right? And so we went to the bathroom and then we came back and it was all very bizarre, right? I mean, the first couple of days of school were really weird. You know, you're not used to the structure. And I remember at in the afternoon, we all had to bring a towel. We were told you must bring a towel. And we brought a towel. And what we did, we stretched the towel out on the ground. You laid it down on the ground. We all lay down on our backs and the teacher would tell us to relax. And she said, "I want to see your fingers curling," right? You know, so that must have been the educational theory at the time, was that the kids need time to calm down in the afternoon and relax. So, you know, it was all, the first couple of weeks were like very weird, you know. I brought my lunch in a lunch pail, which is something I'd never done. And, you know, we all ate together. I lived with my brother and my little sister. You know, suddenly I was with 25 other kids. We had these oilcloth tablecloths on the tables, and we were eating out of our lunch, and we had little thermoses, and you know, it was all like going to a magic place. And then, you know, 6 months in, I knew the drill, right? It was like, don't forget your towel, bring your lunchbox, you know, don't leave your lunchbox at school, you know, and so on. And and it all had a kind of familiarity. I knew what was coming next, and that patterning of experience makes things real for us. You know, it's one of the ways we create our world. If you've had periods where you're not employed, as I have, you know, it's probably not a good idea to just let yourself go, right? You know, when you don't have to get up in the morning, you know, it's probably still a good idea to get up early and not just sleep till noon, right? It's very disorienting after a while if you don't have some structure. So structure, patterning, and repetition make things real. And we need them, right? We need them. It actually helps us in a million different ways. So, you know, I'm an English teacher, and sometimes, more going forward, I teach literature classes. And I remember I loved reading in high school, but I remember taking a literature class. We took the English novel, and in one semester, we read about 10 novels. And it occurred to me, you know, it would take me a year to read 10 novels. And I just read 10 novels in one class in my second semester at the university. And the structure allowed me to do a level of, you know, work and learning that I never would have been able to accomplish on my own. And the collective aspect is like Zazen. So, you know, structure, patterning, and repetition make things feel real. But, you know, that's the magic of human life. You know, we by repeating certain behaviors, we develop habit energy, as we call them in Buddhism. And the habit energy makes things seem normal and natural. And this is a good thing in many ways, but it also becomes imprisoning, right? Can become imprisoning. Because, you know, the more we repeat our behaviors, the deeper embedded they become in our lives, right? So, you know, it's difficult to change after a while because we become so used to the way we have patterned our reality, the way we have patterned our reality through repetition. So it was difficult not to jump in the car in the morning and drive to work. It felt like almost like playing hooky in school to me. It was like, oh, wait, this is so disorienting, right? But, you know, the thing is, patterns create our world, but they can become imprisoning. So, you know, if you develop if you can develop habits that are not beneficial and that are very difficult to break out of. I know that my father was from Newark, New Jersey, and he served in the Navy. During World War II, he was in the Navy and he was in the Pacific. And he survived. His ship got blown up, the Atlanta. But my father was a lifelong smoker. When I was a little boy, I would see him in the bathroom, and he'd be shaving in the bathroom with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. And he was profoundly addicted to cigarettes. And of course, nicotine is the most addictive substance, actually. But even if it hadn't been addictive in itself, chemically addictive, I think that the habit of smoking was deeply part of his life and very difficult for him to break. You know, I had another friend who used to be a smoker, Larry Sullivan. He's a good friend of mine, somebody I have been backpacking with for 40 years. We both went to college together, and in college he was a smoker. And about halfway through college, he got into jogging and athletics, and he decided to give up cigarettes. And he told me, he said, Kurt, the thing that's so hard to give up about smoking is the habit of smoking, right? It's like, so when he and I were both in the same similar classes, we both took a lot of anthropology classes, we took a lot of philosophy classes, and And he would work on these papers. And he said, you know, I will write a couple pages and then I'll have a cigarette. And while I'm writing the pages, somewhere in my mind, I'm thinking, if I'm a good boy and I write these pages, I will get the cigarette. And you finish two or three pages and then you pause. And there's like a ritual. You light the cigarette, you inhale. And of course, you do get this very pleasant sort of boost, the nicotine stimulant. And you feel elated for a little while. And then he would go back and write another couple pages. So, you know, basically when he would write, he would have a pack of cigarettes next to his typewriter. And he'd be tapping away. And, you know, he sort of rationed his cigarettes. It's like every two pages was a cigarette. And this became a comfortable routine for him. And part of it is the addictiveness of the nicotine. Part of it is just the comfort of the routine, but it makes it made it very hard for him to give up smoking, because you know then when he would be writing his papers, there was nothing there to take its place. It was just like this gap in his life, and when he wasn't smoking, he felt nervous. You know, that's the other thing that smoking does. And I had started to talk about my father, and then I started talking about Larry Sullivan. Please accept my apologies, but my father grew up in Newark, and he served in the Navy, and he learned to smoke in the Navy. And he said, what I used to do was I had to keep watch on the ship all night. And he said, when I would have the night watch, there was nothing to do. You're supposed to be looking at, you know, the ocean to see if anything's about to attack the cruiser, you know. And since there's not usually an attack, it's just nothing. And he said he began to get to smoke. Because smoking allowed him to divide up this ocean of time into little periods. You know, so you have your, I don't know what a watch would be, you know, 6 hours or something like that. The standing watch and with some other guys. And he could begin to ration his time, use cigarettes to divide this unstructured expanse of time into cigarettes. You know, so every hour maybe he would have a smoke, and then every half hour would be a smoke. And, you know, the smoke demarcates the time, and it provides a reward, and it gives you something to do, you know. So this is how we structure habit energies. You know, if you are a jogger, as I have been for most of my life, you know, I love to get up early in the morning and jog. And if I don't jog early, I don't do it anymore, but because jogging has ruined my cartilage and my knees, but you know, when I stopped jogging in the morning, I felt really bad. And it wasn't just the physiological aspect. It's, you know, getting out and seeing the trees and breathing the fresh air. I often go for walks, which is a close second, you know. But the habit energy was so powerful. So habit energy is good for us in certain ways, but it begins to create problems if we develop neurotic or destructive patterns, right? And then it's very difficult to get out. Very difficult to get out. And this is especially true with our mental patterns, right? So for example, we all have a certain degree of, you could say, neurosis. You know, we all have a certain degree of anxieties arising from causes we don't allow ourselves to see, you know. And we all have a certain amount of compulsive behaviors, you know, that cause us unhappiness. Now, if somebody were to say to you, well, what are the things you don't want to see? What are the things you use neurotic behavior to avoid confronting? You couldn't tell them because you've been so successful in doing it. Or if you say, what are the things you do compulsively to protect yourself from anxiety or a feeling of malaise or something? You couldn't say what's triggering this. You know, because you've patterned your reality so meticulously. People get into these patterns that cause them to like dissociate or to be detached in unhealthy ways. But they don't know how to change their behavior because the causes are invisible. I remember reading about this woman who was like a very high-powered movie producer. And it's a wonderful, there's a wonderful essay about her by a woman named Martha Stout, who's a psychotherapist. And she's talking about her patient, Julia. And Julia was a movie producer who was very successful, a really brilliant person. But, you know, she came to the therapist because she began to, what she said, caused what she called losing time. So what happened to her, what happened to her regularly was this, you know, she went into her secretary and said, her secretary came into her office and said, they're here now to talk to you, referring to some movie people. And the woman, Julia, said, oh, no, they're not supposed to be here now. They're coming on Friday. And her secretary said, but Julia, it is Friday. And she said, in her mind, it was Tuesday. And then she realized, you know, she couldn't remember anything that happened from Tuesday until that Friday morning. It was just a blank slate. And that this started happening to her. She started losing time. So, you know, there were other moments also where she would, you know, have a task to do, like editing a film script. And it maybe she would sit down to do it. And then a few days later, somebody would say, oh, you did a brilliant job. But she didn't remember editing the film script. And she looked at it and saw her own writing on the film script. But she didn't remember doing it. And, you know, they tested her out neurologically. Everything's fine. So she finally went to a psychotherapist. And the psychotherapist said, you know, something's triggering you to become so dissociated that you lose track of whole days. So in her memory, it was Tuesday. And then, but in reality, it was Friday. And you know, if you asked her, why are you doing this? She couldn't say. We're all a little bit like this. See, this is like a very dramatic example of how we pattern reality in ways that, you know, patterning reality means you pay attention to some things and you have trained yourself to ignore other things. That's what it means to have a structure. That's what it means to repeat. Repetition means you're not going to do anything. You're going to do the same thing over and over again. So we're always excluding things in creating our reality. And we're often driven by, you know, fear and attachment when we do that. So we don't have to lose whole days because we're dissociated, but we all have behaviors that are like that. And we don't know how to get access to them. So, you know, one function of koan training is to begin to see, like, the cracks in our reality that we have hidden from ourselves by constructing these patterns. So, you know, when you work on a koan, you're trying to notice something that you haven't allowed yourself to notice, that the way you've constructed your reality through repetition has excluded something that you're like hiding or that you're trying to protect yourself from. So you know, koan training is trying to bring to consciousness what we have not allowed ourselves to confront, that we've excluded or repressed, right? Often, not always, but often. And, you know, now look, Zen training itself is highly structured. Right? So, you know, it would be difficult to imagine a more regularized activity than Zazen, right? You know, we all got here at 7, 8, 9:40 or 11 o'clock. We all showed up right on time. You know, we all sat down on the cushion as we have trained ourselves to do, straightened our backs, breathed through the hara, through the dantian, and watch the breath, see? So you could say this is the most patterned behavior of all, right? The most structured and repetitive behavior. But, you know, in a way, it's kind of like training you how to get out. You need these patterns, but how do you get out of the pattern? So when you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching your breath, and you're watching your breath, see, it's like we begin to experience like these empty spaces or empty spaces in our reality, like blank spots in our reality. And literally we experience it as emptiness or blankness. So you sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath, you're breathing out, and you know, and then you go on to the next breath, and then you go on to the next breath, but you begin to notice that there are these empty spaces, these, you could say, unpatterned or unstructured spaces in your experience. And you know, it's like those are like holes in, you could say, holes in the reality we create, if this is making any sense at all. It's like we create through patterning, through energy habits, something that feels like a seamless reality, just from repetition. That's all there is to it. And how do you get out of that, though, when you become deeply embedded in those habits? You need to have something like come into to your world from the outside, something you have kept out, something you have excluded. And it seems impossible that this could happen, if this makes any sense, right? Because we're so meticulous in structuring our reality. You know, we generally like to have a world that's totally structured. You know, we go on, even going on vacation, as a matter of fact, is structured, right? I mean, we think of vacations as like spontaneous time, but actually, usually people have pretty rigorous schedules. It's like, it's Barcelona today, some other Madrid tomorrow, right? You know, you go to the, all have your museum guides, so even our empty space, we fill up and structure. But, you know, one of the amazing things is that we can get out of these structures if we cultivate emptiness, right? Emptiness is like opening a hole in our familiar reality so that something unfamiliar can come in. And it works really well. It's like human beings are very bad at, say, randomizing. You know, if you ask somebody, give me a random number, it's almost impossible for humans to come up with a random number. Or a series of random numbers, you'll say, okay, 2, 4, 6, 8, you know, we'll pattern it, you know. I don't know if you know about the I Ching. The I Ching is fascinating, right? The Book of Changes, I highly recommend reading it because it's so sophisticated. You know, I have studied the I Ching for 40 years. I don't usually talk about it. And it's not really as Buddhist. It really comes out of Chinese culture. But, you know, they say that I Ching began not as a series of broken and unbroken lines in various arrangements, but ancient Chinese people would hunt. And they would hunt, like all human beings, this in patterns. And gradually the animals would become wise to their behavior, their patterned behavior, and avoid them. So it's like the hunters would go out at a certain time every day, they'd go to the same place and they'd shoot a deer. Next day, go out at a certain time, shoot a deer. The deer realized, I'm not going to go to that place at that time, I'm going to go somewhere else. And also, you know, eventually the Chinese would wipe out all the deer in a certain area. So how do you randomize? How do you get out? When you're stuck in patterns, how do you get out of your patterns? And what the Chinese did was, ancient Chinese people would take scapula bones and put them on coals until they cracked. And then there were people who were like shaman, right? Shaman, like holy men. And they would read the cracks in the scapula. And those cracks in the scapula are supposed to be the basis of the I Ching. And, you know, many computer scientists and mathematicians have said the I Ching is like it's a randomizing machine in a certain way, right? It's trying to show you patterns that you can't foresee or predict. See, so you know, they developed a scapulomancy, or this technique of reading cracks in the scapula, as a way of defeating their own tendency to repeat and repeat and repeat. Well, you know, I think Buddhism understands this problem very well, right? I mean, the concept of karma and the concept of cause and effect help us to see how we create repetitive realities that become difficult to break out of. In fact, the word samsara actually means going around and around in a circle. So samsara means repetitive behavior that isn't liberating, and in fact, that you can't break out of. So you know, the more deeply embedded we become in our energy habits, the more difficult it is to get out of them. In fact, I have a friend of mine who is a psychotherapist, and she was saying, you know, this is a big issue. She said, because, you know, when you're 20 and you go to a psychotherapist, those energy habits, those mental patterns are fairly deeply ingrained. But by the time you're 50 or 60, it's very difficult for you to get out. It's not impossible, but it's difficult. So you know, the question of how do we undo our patterns, how do we see what we haven't allowed ourselves to see, is a big issue. And, you know, from the Zen standpoint, it's a very big issue, because what we haven't allowed ourselves to see is enlightenment itself, enlightened consciousness itself. You know, probably it's the case that as we were growing up, we had moments that were like enlightenment, or even moments of enlightenment, where we feel completely outside of ourselves and connected to everything. But in the process of growing up, we create these patterns. And the more we create patterns, and the more meticulous we are about it, the farther we get from that kind of unstructured, spontaneous connectedness. So how do we get back to that, right? One way to think about Zazen is, even though it's in fact highly structured, it's sending you like a little message that in the middle of structure, it's possible to be open to the outside. It's like we create this fence around ourselves, but it's possible to open like little holes in that fence and let in some reality. So Zazen puts a great deal of importance on the experience of emptiness, because it's creating a hole or an interruption in our patterning behavior. And it allows us to experience unstructured, unpatterned reality for as long as we can stand it, right? You know, so, you know, when a teacher gives a student a koan, you know, generally speaking, people don't like to be out of control. They don't like to leave their patterns. And so, you know, they'll try to interpret the koan in terms of familiar things they already know. So if you look at this koan, this story, it's fairly easy to interpret it intellectually. You know, there's a girl who is deep in samadhi, and Manjushri can't bring her out of samadhi. And the Buddha says, try it. And Manjushri can't, even though he's the foremost of all the bodhisattvas. And then the Buddha summons Momyo from under the earth. And Momyo's just this beginning trainee. And he snaps his fingers and the girl wakes up. And we could say, okay, well, it's obvious. You know, this is a critique of the Buddhist leadership. This is a prominent male teacher, and he enjoys all the privileges and respect, but here's this guy who nobody knows, and he solves the problem. So it's a little guy to the rescue. You know, that's clearly the message of the koan, but that's not really going to liberate us, right? I mean, what we need to do is find our momyo, right? What have we buried in the ground and haven't had an encounter with, right? So what is our momyo? What is your momyo? Right? And you know, momyo is a welcome figure here, but we don't always want to meet our momyo, right? Sometimes it's difficult. So people working with koans, you know, at first they want to give an intellectual explanation because that allows them to repeat their patterns, right? Of course I know this. I'll use what I already know to make sense of the unfamiliar. And the teacher, if the teacher's a good teacher, will say, no, that's too intellectual. I'm sorry. And then you're sort of like adrift. You're adrift. And you're in this place where you don't know how to set, you don't know where to set your feet. And there's no place for you to grab with your hands, right? You're just drifting. And this is difficult because now we're outside of the, we're in unpatterned territory. And being in unpatterned territory is not comfortable a lot of the time. In fact, you know, even Hakuin Zenji, the great Japanese teacher, said, he called koans, he said, these vile koans, right? Because nobody wants to go through that, sit in that the uncertainty of not knowing. You know, you have to answer, but you don't know the answer. And you can't rely on anything you know. So a lot of Zen practice is drifting in uncertainty, in not knowing. It's you're in a blank state on the cushion and you're repeating the turning phrase, right? One hand clapping, one hand clapping, right? And you're thinking, what the hell? You know, what am I doing here? You know, and if you could answer the question of what you're doing here, you'd be wasting your time. Because any answer you give would be your old mental patterns, right? So how do you randomize? How do you do something that's truly outside your wheelhouse, you know? So you sit in uncertainty. And luckily, you know, luckily the unconscious mind is much more receptive than the conscious mind. You know, I was reading some time ago, Daniel, I don't know if you've seen Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. But Daniel Kahneman has a Nobel Prize, and I don't have a Nobel Prize, and I don't expect to get one. But I think he's wrong, right? Daniel Kahneman says, you know, basically that we have an instinctual mind that's fast and that it's coming out of the unconscious, that we can't trust it, and that we have to listen to our reasoning mind. And there's some truth to that. But Buddhists would say, Daniel, underneath that mind you can't trust, there's a mind you can trust, right? You know, your snap judgments, some people in my family, I'm sorry to say, are, many people are health professionals, but there's a couple sort of outliers who are anti-vaxxers. I'm sorry to say. It's like, I can't believe it, but it's true, right? And it's like madness. It's like, so I agree that they need to be dealt with rationally. You need to sit down and talk to them, right? But on the other hand, I think Kahneman's wrong. I think that we have a deeper intelligence than the one he's talking about, which is this big mind, right? The big mind has a kind of wisdom that the small mind, the discriminating mind, doesn't have. And the big mind is taking in much more information than the small mind. So, you know, sometimes you'll know, you'll feel something instinctively before it's clear why you're anxious, right? You know, or you'll feel joy and you won't even know why, but after a while you realize why, right? So there's this deeper processor, if you want to put it that way, the unconscious mind. And so when we begin to drift in uncertainty on the cushion, you know, we've broken out of our patterned behavior, and we're in a sort of, can be sort of like discomfort or even agony sometimes. And in that process, we sometimes come across things we have hidden, the momyos that we have hidden from ourselves, right? You know, something, you know, that woman I was speaking of earlier, Julia, had grown up in a home where she was the victim, I'm sorry to say, of, you know, parental abuse. She was physically abused as a child, and she had learned to use dissociation to tune it out. And in the course of her therapy, the therapist said to her, Julia, she said, tell me about your high school. And Julia said, I can't remember anything about high school. She said, isn't that true for everybody? And the therapist said, no, as a matter of fact, you know, we we can probably remember more about our high school than we wish, right? So Julia had shut out all of this stuff. And in the process of going through the psychotherapy, difficult, unpacking difficult material was part of the practice, right? She patterned all that away, you could say. Bringing it back into reality required a lot of hard work. Well, our goal in Zen practice isn't the same as psychotherapy. It's enlightenment. But there are very similar elements to it. You know, so we too are encountering our momyos, you know, the things we haven't wanted to face. And as we encounter these momyos, they're difficult to deal with. They don't come at our bidding, they just show up. You know, so sometimes you'll be working on a koan and you'll realize that, you know, you felt terribly something maybe your brother did to you long ago, we've never really recovered from. Maybe he hurt your feelings in some way that you just buried, and it's right there under the surface. It's been affecting your behavior, right? And this might come up, and you might, you know, typically people think this has nothing to do with their koan. People will come into Dokusan, and I'll say, what's happening with your koan? They'll say, nothing, I'm stuck, nothing's happening. I'll say, well, tell me what you're thinking about. And they'll say, well, you know, when I was five, my brother humiliated me in front of my friends, and I keep thinking about that all day. It's like, well, maybe that has something to do with your koan. So, you know, things like that become obstacles. You know, we secrete patterned behaviors around these events in order to conceal them from ourselves. And we're successful, you know, we're really good at it. But they haunt us. They're like the karma we haven't confronted. And they create obstacles for us later on. So Zen practice has this dimension of unearthing the momyos. But we become liberated by encountering our momyos. See, I mean, if we could just sit down on the cushion and be in bliss, Zazen would be a drug. It would be like, it should be a, whatever you call it, a Schedule One drug. Nobody should do Zazen if that's what we do, right? You could commit murder and sit down on the cushion and then be relaxed and happy. That would be bad, right? So you know, Zazen isn't about being happy necessarily. It's about being connected to the world in a truthful and unobstructed way, which makes us happy. So, you know, we're working through our obstacles. And that means that sometimes Zen is not pretty, right? Sometimes it's that Zen is not, you know, necessarily joyous. You know, there's moments where, you know, I've had moments at Sesshin where, you know, I've really been furious. You know, I haven't always known why. It's just, you know, I'll be sitting on the cushion and I just feel this fury. Later, I realize what has caused that. And, you know, sometimes confronting our obstacles is difficult, but, you know, after it's over, you feel so free. It's like one by one, you're unearthing and unearthing your obstacles or the things you've hidden from yourself. And the world gets to be more and more complete, and you become more and more connected to it. And that's really a kind of profound liberation, right? Now we're returning to that enlightened mind that we have had glimpses of all our lives, but in a more sustained way. So we're lucky that we have this capacity to do this. I was going to do two koans for the price of one today, but I see we're almost out of time. But there's another koan I just want to mention briefly. It's called, it's in the Book of Serenity. It's Guishan's Active Consciousness. The Guishan asked Yangshan, if somebody suddenly said all sentient beings have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on, how would you prove it in experience? Yangshan said, if a monk comes, I said, hey, you. If the monk turns his head, I say, what is it? If he hesitates, I say, not only their consciousness is boundless and unclear, but they have no fundamental to rely on. That was not read very well, but the point is that we all have this active consciousness. You know, that our world is not held together by our patterns of repetition. Those actually keep us from the world or screen the world out. You know, under the surface of this artifice we have created, this fabric we have created, is reality. And when we begin to make holes in that fabric, you know, the reality shines through, and it shines through because we have this deeper Buddha mind, we say. Once in the old days, in the time of the World Honored One, Manjushri went to the assembly of the Buddhas and he found that everyone had departed to his original dwelling place. So all the bodhisattvas were gone. Only a girl remained sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Manjushri asked Shakyamuni Buddha, why can the girl get near the Buddha's throne? Why I cannot? Shakyamuni said, bring her out of samadhi and ask her yourself. Manjushri walked around the girl three times, snapped his fingers, took her up to Brahma heaven, and exerted all his marvelous powers to bring her out of her meditation, but in vain. See, he can't break her out of her habits. He can't break her out of her energy habits. The World Honored One said, even 100,000 Manjushris cannot wake her up. But down below, past 1,200 million lands as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there's a Bodhisattva Momyo. He will arouse her from samadhi. This is the thing she has concealed from herself. Instantly, the Bodhisattva emerged from the earth and made a bow to the World Honored One who gave him his imperial orders. The Buddha says, wake her up. The Bodhisattva went over to the girl and snapped his fingers once, and at this she came out of samadhi. So the break in patterns and a deep encounter with reality. Mulan's comment, old Shakyamuni, now remember, when Mulan is critical, he's being complimentary. So in Zen, you know, the worst thing, I am not a typical Zen teacher because I think people work so hard, and Americans have, I think, based on my own experience, sort of like low self-regard. So, you know, I think people do need a pat on the back, and they generally are very self-critical. But in the context of Chinese culture, you know, Mulan doesn't compliment people because he doesn't want them to be arrogant. So when he criticizes people, he's actually paying them a compliment. You know, D.T. Suzuki, Daisetsu Suzuki's Dharma name was Blockhead. Blockhead. And you can say, wow, his teacher named him a blockhead, you know, what an insult. But actually, it's an insult, it's a compliment, because it's such an insult, right? If that makes any sense. Old Shakyamuni put on a pity drama on the stage and failed to enlighten the masses. I want to ask you, Manjushri is the teacher of the seven Buddhas. Why couldn't he arouse the girl from her samadhi? How was it that Momyo, a bodhisattva at the beginner stage, could do it? If you understand this intimately, you will enjoy Nagya's grand samadhi in the busiest activity of consciousness. Mulan's verse, one was successful, the other was not. Both secured freedom of mind. One in a god mask, the other in a devil mask, even in defeat, a beautiful performance.